Dementia in practice is recorded and produced in multiple locations. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the various lands on which we meet. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and celebrate the diversity of Aboriginal peoples, their ongoing cultures, and connections to the lands and waters of Australia. Hi, Hilton Coppy here with you again, and welcome back to Dementia in Practice, the podcast that's made by GPs for GPs and for all other health professionals who are interested in learning more about dementia. Speaking of health professionals, today we're going to meet with a speech pathologist, one of the number of allied health professionals who can be of great assistance in the care of a person with dementia, and in this situation also with their support network. So, Steph, you had an opportunity to interview a speech pathologist for this episode.
Yes, I spoke to Kim Teresi from Speech Pathology Australia about her experiences of supporting people living with dementia via the use of speech pathology.
I guess speech pathologists are bringing their expertise in neurogenic communication and swallowing impairment and our individualised therapy approach to our work in dementia. So we work with the person with dementia or changes in their cognition and communication and their support network around them to address those changes that they're seeing. You know, particularly in relation to communication, we have to remember that communication is a two-way process. So successful communication relies on not just the person, but also their communication partner and how well they respond or deliver their message. So it's also equally important that spouses, family, friends, paid carers, etc., also have the opportunity to understand how to maintain communication for that ongoing connection. So I guess that's the first thing, is that, you know, we might be working directly with the person, but we might also have a role to be involved in providing education, support and strategies to those people around them.
Because one of the things that I notice, certainly in the people that I see, is that there can be a lot of frustration on both sides. Mm-hmm. So yeah. People living with dementia, you know, if they're having word finding difficulties or mm-hmm. they're having trouble remembering things and they might be a bit more repetitive, they find that frustrating in themselves, but also their care partner or spouse or whoever also finds it frustrating, but they don't really know how to handle it or what to do in order to support that person. So there's this kind of tension going on right from the beginning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, we all know that dementia impacts, you know, the wider circles of support, but definitely when it comes to those changes around communication, it has a major impact, not just for the person, but the people around them. So it might be, as you said, the direct partner and their day-to-day interactions and how much they can, you know, really, we want to be setting them up for that good connection and maintaining the relationship. You know, research has actually shown that communication change is a significant carer burden indication. And at times it's come up in research as a high predictor of early placement and residential aged care if people don't have those supports. And I guess then the compounding issue there is that frequently extended family and friends can often drop away at that time because of their concern about not knowing what to say. You know, how do I say things? You know, it's really common for us to go and meet up with somebody and say, so what have you been doing? And of course, somebody with short-term memory difficulties, that's not the most helpful start to a conversation, and it can get really difficult for them. So even just providing opportunities to do Zoom calls and work with the friends, if that's something that the person wants us to do, to give them some education and support about, look, this is how you can go about it, this is what will help. And all of those things are really important for mood. Otherwise, we know that people with communication difficulties can often become quite socially isolated and depressed.
And we also know that social isolation actually can have an adverse effect on cognition. So
Absolutely. Having
that continued communication is a way of people staying engaged, which helps with cognitive stimulation.
I think, yeah, there's that social engagement, which is so important, as we've just said, and independence. So with a speech pathologist, We're not just about therapy and getting better. We're also looking at how you can do things effectively using alternate strategies or communication aids if that's what's needed. So we take that strengths-based approach when we work with somebody to look at doing a really detailed assessment would help us understand where are the cognitive strengths and where are the areas of difficulty and how can we compensate for those areas of difficulty so that we can help people stay as independent as possible. Because I think that otherwise, I certainly have seen where somebody might have that, what we might consider a mild impairment and word finding difficulty, but I've seen that create quite a significant disability in terms of limiting what they're doing in terms of their social participation and independence. They can stop, you know, going out to the shops, ordering their own food and drink, making those phone calls to manage their own affairs, concern about, oh, what would I do if I suddenly couldn't think of the word? So there can be that early over-reliance on spouse or partners to do things for people. And that really contributes to increased dependence and reduced opportunities for people.
We often talk about how when people want to step in and act rather than empowering yes. somebody to be able to do it themselves. And I suppose that highlights totally the importance right. of like a more timely diagnosis as well, because that intervention, I should think the sooner you start, the more benefit you have in maintaining those skills.
That's exactly right.
Independence.
Yes. You know, often in the past, I used to mainly get referred people with dementia much later in the course of their disease, and often only once swallowing difficulties had become apparent to everyone. And so that they'd be referred for swallowing, and you could see the sort of missed opportunities that we could have had earlier on to support communication. And there's still things that we would do in those later stages, potentially with the communication environment and with the communication partners and giving them some education about how to best support the person. But in terms of embedding strategies, embedding use of aids, we need to do that as early as possible. And it is still possible to do that early in the disease. There is still that learning capacity. If you do it in the right way and with repetition, et cetera, you can embed them. But obviously, as the disease progresses, that becomes, you know, at some point that will become too difficult for the person to then learn a new way of doing things.
But I suppose also this highlights why you need to get the spouse or the relatives in earlier as well, so that they can start right at the beginning to understand about the communication, because they're going to be the kind of stable person there in the yes. background, adapting the way that they communicate as things progress.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are some of the techniques that you might be utilising as a speech pathologist? Is it helpful as a GP to be able to explain to people what they might be able to expect?
So I guess going to see a speech pathologist, we'd first want to have a really deep understanding, I guess, as to what's been happening with either the communication or swallowing changes, and understand where or when communication breakdown is most often happening, looking for where are the opportunities for us to target. Is it that, you know, really having difficulty when I have my weekly conversation with my daughter on the phone, telling her, you know, having something to tell her about what I've been doing? Is it just communicating with my spouse about what we're going to have for dinner? What are some examples of those things, and where are the opportunities? We'd probably ideally like to do a bit of language-based assessment. And as I said before, that really helps inform us to understand where are the cognitive strengths and where are the areas of difficulty, because that sort of helps us proceed with our strengths-based approach to targeting those communication breakdown situations with the right sort of customized strategies. So what strategy works with one person doesn't necessarily work with the other person, because of those differences that are happening with the cognitive profiles. We play a really important role in that post-diagnostic education and support in providing people with detailed information about the nature of what this looks like, what to expect, particularly for those people with those language-led dementias, you know, frontotemporal dementias that perhaps are a lot less known out in the community, and they're really grappling with that often and really feeling alone. Often being able to give them a bit more specific advice about, yeah, look, we understand your variant, we get where it is, this is what it looks like, and also connecting them with other people with a similar condition often has really enormous benefits.
Do you run any sort of group?
Yes.
So on that, in terms of peer-to-peer support, because I think that's one of the things that's
really important,
really valuable. Yeah.
I see that as being quite life-changing for lots of the people that I've worked with over time. So yes, definitely. Those social challenges that we mentioned before, it's often not seen by the person with dementia as being a great strategy to connect them to mainstream social groups. Sometimes that works for some people, but many times if somebody's got quite a significant communication challenge, they're not necessarily feeling comfortable in those mainstream social groups. But speech pathologists will often run community communication support groups with a speech pathologist embedded to support the use of your own individualized strategy or the way you can use your communication aid within a conversation. You're also meeting with people who are living the same condition as you, and that has enormous spin-off benefits as well as just the communication practice and the social interaction. So it gives us lots of opportunity for that education. We've often do groups for the spouses or partners as well, and letting them have a chance to connect and share strategies and so on.
I love listening to the way Kim spoke about the work that she does, and in particular, the language that she used I found so respectful, like talking about a person's support networks. It's so non-judgmental and inclusive, and also talking about communication partners as an expression. We sometimes talk about loved ones, and sometimes the communication partners may not be that loved. And so just that kind of language I found was so helpful. And Marita, it reminded you of a story you were telling us before about an experience that one of your patients had around respectful communication aids.
Yeah, so this was a patient who has been diagnosed with primary progressive aphasia, so has those sort of significant language difficulties that are going to get worse. And she came back from her the diagnostic process, I guess, with one of the local geriatricians, and I was just asking her, you know, how did you go with the process? And she was, you know, saying how good it was and how lovely the geriatrician was. And then she goes, oh, yeah, and he gave me this, and pulled out this little card that she can carry in her wallet, which is, communication aid. It sort of outlines what difficulties, what her diagnosis, what her difficulties may be, so that if she's having trouble, she can just hand that to someone, or if she's preempting she might have trouble, she could hand that to someone so that they understood that there might be some difficulties. But the thing that was really lovely was that the specialist asked permission to give it to her. So said, you know, we've got these cards that can sometimes help. You know, I don't know that you need it yet, but it might be something you might want to use down the track. How would you feel about having this? And it just really was sort of really heartening to hear a story where there had been that absolute a respect and asking someone permission for if they wanted this assistance at this point in time. So she was quite proud of her little card, even though she, you know, rightly said, oh, she doesn't need it yet. And the importance of doing things like that early on, which is what sort of Kim alluded to. And I think Kim's going to talk to us a little bit more about what other sort of aids might be available for people who do have some language or communication difficulties.
Sometimes what we may do with some people where it's appropriate is that we may talk about practicing the use of alternative augmentative communication, AAC, which might be low-tech or high-tech communication aids. So particularly where you've got somebody, say, with a progressive non-fluent aphasia who is likely to lose their speech over time, we can do some voice banking on an electronic communication device that enables them to continue to use their voice output on an electronic communication aid. So that's one of the things we might do. But we might also, in some cases, do some post-diagnostic rehabilitation that's targeted on a, you know, a direct therapy approach on word retrieval or sentence formation. And that can be something quite targeted, you know, like I've done that before, quite targeted with somebody who was going to be he wanted to be able to participate in his daughter's wedding and provide his dad's speech. So that was something that we really targeted in terms of the vocabulary that we then targeted in our therapy. The other couple of things I'll quickly mention are swallowing assessment and mealtime management strategies, right through to end-of-life supports and looking at those supports when swallowing and communication is getting more difficult at that stage as well.
If I'm sitting in my GP surgery with somebody who's perhaps newly diagnosed and I'm thinking about this person would benefit from a speech pathologist, what's the best way to go about arranging that for the individual? Is it via a GP management plan or through their aged care package?
Referral pathways do remain, you know, tricky sometimes for people with dementia to access those appropriate allied health services such as speech pathology. Certainly GPs can use chronic disease management plans. A speech pathologist can be engaged through a chronic disease management plan. And that might be a way that you can at least engage initially with somebody. But we do know that access is really limited and the structure of CDMs are not really fit for purpose in terms of what they fund. In terms of all of the things I was just describing that a speech pathologist might be involved in before, are not funded under the structure of a CDM. So I think you mentioned some of the other funding pathways, and I think they're really important to know about. So for people who are older than 65, knowing about being able to refer via MyAgeCare is really important, because that is how they can get referred on to funded supports through the Commonwealth Home Support Program or Home Care Package. Both of those programs will obviously next year be rolled into the new Supported Home Program. So yes, I'd say that going through MyAgeCare gives the person that opportunity to access the therapy services in more of a way that is probably going to be more appropriate for them. And obviously for people under 65, looking at the potential under NDIS. So it's really important that people do get onto NDIS where possible, because that's going to provide them with the right sort of level of funding, hopefully, that they can access therapy services like speech pathology. Often it's really useful to engage with a speech pathologist early to help with that application process and provide the functional reports to help them with their application. Because you mentioned before that often those communication changes early on can be quite subtle, but you know, speech pathology can really focus in drawing out and highlighting the functional impacts of those communication changes. It might be somebody still working, but they're needing lots of scaffolding and lots of structures and could benefit with different aids that would help them do their job for longer. And that's a really, you know, definite worthwhile NDIS goal. So they would be the funding mechanisms. It is important to look for a speech pathologist with expertise and experience in dementia. We're growing. We're trying as a profession to continue to provide more professional development, and we're developing national practice guidelines, etc., to engage more people in this space. Otherwise, a speech pathologist that provides services to people with other neurological conditions, particularly traumatic brain injury, stroke, or progressive neurological conditions, will be able to often help you in this area. There is a Find a Speech Pathologist search engine on the Speech Pathology Australia website, and you can use filters for geographic location and area of practice to target your search and ensure that you can find the right speech pathologist with the right expertise. Otherwise, I'd say check in with your local community health service or hospital rehabilitation outpatient settings if you're really struggling. If they're not able to see the person, they may at least be able to point you in the right direction of a local speech pathologist that they know.
Mm, that's certainly how I found my local ones. I think I contacted you and then you put me in touch with somebody working in the hospital, and then they put me in touch with all the ones working in the community. So there was a sort of chain reaction. But once you know who's in your area, it's really invaluable because you have those relationships that you can build up on, and it makes it easier for patients to work out where to go as well. So it is worth knowing what's going on. I guess my only other question is for people who live in rural and remote regions. I think you mentioned that sometimes there's the opportunity to do video.
Look, definitely. And there's been a lot more research. I mean, there was pre-COVID, but obviously COVID also facilitated things to happen for everyone, I think, in a very fast way. But there is certainly research about the efficacy of using telehealth practice in this area. So yes, there are certainly many practices that provide telehealth services, and we can use the various tools that are at our disposal online. That includes things like sharing screens to share our therapy stimuli and getting people to take, you know, screenshots of what they've just written out so that we can see, you know, there's various ways that we can work with the telehealth environment to make it an appropriate therapeutic environment.
Did you have any other things that you felt were important to get across?
Yeah, look, particularly in relation to communication, we know that, you know, there are obviously some conditions, particularly your primary progressive aphasias, etc., that may be more overt in terms of the initial changes to speech and language. But really, at some stage, all dementia variants are likely to experience some change in swallowing, eating, or communication. But generally, what I'd say is suspect and act early in terms of communication, that they, things that may not be quite overt in your room, because in a sort of structured Q&A setting of a brief consult in your room, or the sort of standard cognitive screening tests we use, like Mini-Mental, these changes aren't always really very apparent. So I'd say that listen to a person who might be reporting changes to their speech and language, even if they're younger, because we know research shows us that those people with primary progressive aphasia often take quite a long time to get diagnosed, in the sense that initially people aren't too sure about following up on their reported changes, or they might be misdiagnosed as simply having anxiety. But otherwise, you might need to directly ask about changes to communication to actually find out more. So things that you might need to ask directly about might be, you know, has the person noticed any increase in difficulties finding the words they want to say? Have they noticed it's more difficult to make themselves understood by others? Have they noticed any changes to their writing and spelling? That can be quite an early change, even in Alzheimer's disease, with people having wrong letters coming out when they're trying to write down something. And I don't know about you, but I rely really heavily on writing down things like for a shopping list or in my diary or calendar. I'd have a memory difficulty too if I couldn't write those things down. So often that really exacerbates, if you like, the functional impact of memory changes. Or has somebody noticed they're having more difficulty following groups, conversations socially, or programs on the TV, as well as changes to their swallowing? So I think it might be worth a direct probe or conversation with those things, because we know that there's often presently a gap after diagnosis for people with dementia and accessing services. And people with dementia really, you know, have been very vocal in talking about that they want access to rehabilitation and reablement. And GPs have a really important role to play to ensure that that person has a support plan in place with referrals that can include allied health and can ensure that the person is leading as, you know, a connected and independent life as possible, I guess.
It was so great listening to Kim, and thank you so much, Steph, for bringing her to us for the podcast. I just loved her approach, the very person-centered, respectful approach. And there were so many things that she said that resonated with me. Particularly, there was the bit about making a diagnosis earlier on in a dementia while people still have the capacity to embed new learning, was, I think, the phrase that she used. And the other thing that really struck me, Steph, was this term that an apparently mild impairment of speech can lead to a significant disability in a person's life. And I wondered what your thoughts were around that.
So I guess thinking about acting early, it's really thinking about the ability to assist somebody with rehabilitation, which means helping people to maintain optimum function so that they can interact with their environments. And I think with speech pathology, that's one of the things that that really is looking at. The more that you can support and scaffold someone early on, the more that they can maintain their, you know, social interactions, their activities and speech, which is so important in order for us to communicate with our, with anyone really. And interestingly, I thought it was interesting that she again highlighted how speech can sometimes be one of those first things that people notice as a symptom of concern, and shows us that it's always not just memory to be asking about. And if people are flagging concerns with their speech, we need to take that seriously, because it could be a marker of something significant. And again, I always ask about writing difficulties, because I have had several people who have described that they're no longer able to write letters and there's something wrong with the way that they write. And so just recognizing that communication is more than just speech. The other thing I wanted to just raise awareness around was the really useful tools that are available on the Forward with Dementia website. And it talks about speech pathology, but also all of the other allied health professionals and how useful they can be, and has some of those tools that Marita mentioned in terms of a dementia ID card and also a circle of friends document, so that you can help communicate your diagnosis with people around you at a timing of your choosing.
And we'll put a link to the Forward with Dementia site in the show notes for this episode. Thanks again, Steph, for bringing us this incredibly helpful interview. And thank you for joining us on Dementia in Practice. We look forward to being with you again sometime soon. See you. Bye.
Dementia in Practice is an initiative of Dementia Training Australia, which is funded by the Australian Government.
If you are a GP and you'd like to claim CPD points for listening to this episode, check out our suggestions in the show notes section.